Yeah, now I think I have a microphone, and it's blinking red, so I guess it's a recording, and we get a lecture video. Yeah, again, if you have a laptop, go to this Socrative system. And since no one had strong opinions about this, and it's easy for me, I keep using that one. So log in there, and if you still have any questions, please type in. Second administrative topic is that a few weeks ago, I introduced this peer-wise system, which is for you to make questions for one another and then make huge amount of these drills to get better understanding of Haskell syntax. I kind of said that this is mandatory during this course on the grounds of if I hadn't said that this was mandatory, no one would have done anything with it. So we tried. And we have something like 30 questions in the peer-wise system already. And last lecture I asked you if you had any opinions whether this peer-wise thing is useful. You said that it's kind of useful, you get more practice. But no one had any strong opinions about whether we should do it or not. So, open question. Did you find the peer-wise useful? If you found it useful, I will keep using it. I will keep using it for the next course also. And I will keep it as a mandatory course task, so you have to actually try. Or you can vote that, yeah, I didn't get any benefit from that, and we can drop the tool entirely from the courses. Or you can just say neutral, I don't really care. And basically, two ways to answer. Write your answer to Socrative if you are not willing to shout out, and otherwise, you know, shout out. And as usual, the ball denotes who has the right of way in talking, so, you know, if you don't want to comment, throw the ball around until it hits someone who might want to comment. Or that happens. I really need to get something that is more easy to catch. Okay. Yeah, I guess this peer-wise is pretty neutral. You know, really, no one has any opinions about this at all? Mildly useful. Okay, we'll keep on doing that, and it's mandatory to try. Okay, I can give you a new identifier. Just email me what you want, and I can write it down. So, no problem. I think peer-wise also has this remind me of my password.
Yeah, yeah. It has, but you have to give the password the
log
email address. And I did not give because when I made the account, I would remember this. But
yeah, okay, just mail me some magic word, and I'll add that as an identifier for you. Okay, no opinions about peer-wise then. I mean, this is the final call for any opinions about peer-wise, so I won't ask this again. So if no one shouts, we'll continue using this. You have to use it, and it will be fun. One, two, yeah, no comments about peer-wise. So, agenda for today. We are going to look at few recursion exercises. Mainly we are going to do the merge sort. That is because of two reasons. We gave you the wrong feedback on merge sort. We lied on the feedback, accidentally, mind you. And it's a nice recursion exercise. Second, we are going to do the n-queens, or I'm going to demonstrate how to do the n-queens problem, since it's a really easy problem masquerading as a very hard problem. So I kind of want to show you how I approach this and why I think it's easy. And finally, we discuss bit about how to do input and output with Haskell, which is really strange since, you know, this is the sixth lecture we have been doing, 6 weeks of Haskell, and we still don't know how to read files or send messages over network or download a web page or do any sort of thing like that. So we discuss a little bit about this. It's a kind of a special topic in any functional programming course. So any additions, any additional topics you want me to cover? And how can I motivate you to participate? Any additional topic that you want to cover, which is something I can cover, I do 3 push-ups for every topic that you suggest. Does this help? Come on, it's not so serious. 4 push-ups? No, okay, we'll go with this agenda. You know, at some point in life you have to start talking to lecturers. So, exercises. Standard procedure. Since it's pretty useless if I discuss about the exercise and show you the answers, I want you to discuss about the answers. So, you know, form groups. Everyone seems to be already grouped, so you know the procedure. Then use this socrative, and I forgot to check if there's... Ah, pairwise needs links. Okay, we'll add that. So, form groups, use the socrative to vote, and then after you have voted, try to convince people next to you that your answer is the correct answer. And then we talk, have a small discussion about this. And the whole point is that you see at least few different answers and can compare to your own answer. And first is this deal function. And let's set up the socrative, finish, submit, blah. Yeah. So, we had this merge sort exercise, which was basically already pre-decomposed into 3 parts. First part was to take a list, split it into 2 approximately equal parts. Second part was merge 2 sorted lists into 1 sorted list, and third was actually do a merge sort. So, basically this is a rather trivial bit of code, I think. But I kind of want your opinions about this, just to see if the mistaken comments by the teaching assistants have affected your mind already or not. So, vote. Which of these would you consider to be the best solution? And what kind of corrections would you make for the rest? An answer is actually rather tricky. And it helps you to consider the qualities you want from this function. It's part of the sorting algorithm. And you want, of course, the sorting algorithm to be as fast as possible. So dealing a list should do as few operations as possible. Yeah. Make a quick vote and then start discussing. Oh. Yeah, like the comment said, the first bullet is of course wrong. We are talking about the function that splits a list into half and not the function that is merging the lists. That's a copy-paste error. I have plenty of those in my slides, so don't get bothered. you are about done, wave your hand or something. Can I recognize? Yeah, one people is done with this. Two people. Three, four. I guess you're waving for the entire group. So mostly done. Are you busy still? Let's have a 3 minutes more. Done now. So let's look at the results. So this is actually a more harder question than these usually are. So most people consider A to be the best, B to be least good of them all, and C to be C is rather popular. One third of you like C. So I guess we could go and have a small live chat about this. So you have the ball. Did you answer? Which is your favorite and why did you decide it was nice? Actually faster to do it like this. In DLP you have to calculate the length twice, you have to traverse the list twice, and then you have to take half of the list, traverses the list, the midpoint, then drop, traverse also the midpoint, and it has more traversals. Yeah. Quite nice. Anyone chose something else? Or, pass the ball around. And you can always throw the ball away if you don't want to talk, so it's nothing to be afraid of. So, which of these bars did you contribute to? A. Any additional reasons why you should choose A? Yeah, excellent. Excellent point. So if I take, if we consider just the deal function and not the merge sort that will contain this, then if I take deal B or deal C, and I throw in an infinite list, list of all natural numbers, for example, perfectly valid in Haskell. These B and C, they are going to calculate the length of that, which of course never is going to be finished. It will compute that till the end of days. So DLB and DLC actually don't work for infinite lists. And this is a very good reason to prefer DLA. Yeah, anything else you thought about? If not, then throw the ball away. Every time you don't have anything to say, just throw the ball. And try to avoid headshots, because those are not nice. So, opinions, which did you choose? Oh, that's my mistake. Sorry. That's definitely my mistake. I made the slides and put the A in front of the name and missed. That's not, the problem of the actual code. It's my mistake. For some reason, I can't force myself to read my own slides, which probably tells you a little bit how entertaining these are. So, if you mentally correct A, then B was your answer. Another great, reason to choose B. Any other opinions? Since one third of you chose C, and we haven't heard anyone who says C yet, so pass the poll once more. Statistically, we should have a C group. you're going to get hit by a ball. So I'll pick up the ball and you can tell me what's done. What? Okay, we lost the ball. Ah, there.
Yep.
Here you go. Okay, so C is nice and short. A works for infinite lists. So if we restrict our thoughts to the merge sort, then we don't need the property of this working with infinite lists. That's usually a rather important property and it makes the code more reusable. But if we are considering only the deal function inside a merge sort, what would be our criteria? You know, one thing I said earlier is that we need something that is fast. I mean, we want as fast as possible sorting algorithm. Any other criteria? One criteria that is often used with sorting algorithms is called stability, meaning that if I sort a list by some partial ordering, I have a list of numbers, and for example, I sort them in descending order by their absolute value. So minus 3 is bigger than 1 and so on. You get my meaning. So I don't sort them by their natural order, I sort them according to some function, like the absolute value function. And if I sort the list by, let's say, the absolute value function, and the list is already sorted, so I have something like, well, let's have an example. I have a list like this, and it's well sorted. If I consider only the absolute value of the numbers, it's quite okay. So what I would like is that if I have a sorting function, this is going to need something. Have to import about a jillion things to get this work. So if I compare by the absolute value, I should of course get the exactly same list back. Right. If I look at this result, let's fix this so it actually makes sense. So now I get the good example. If I sort this list by the absolute value, it is already sorted. I get the same list back. And this doesn't actually have to hold for your sorting algorithm, because equivalently I could have a list like this. This is sorted according to absolute value also. I mean, this is, if I have only the criteria that I can check the absolute value of the numbers in the list, this is also a sorted list, right? I mean, it doesn't matter if the minus 1 precedes 1 or vice versa. It's sorted according to this criteria. This kind of a sort, if I get a result like this, then the sort is not stable. Elements that are equal must remain in the same order that they appear in the list to make the algorithm stable. Now, then let's make a quick check if I made any sense. Finish. Quick. You know, it needs absolutely horrendous amount of clicking. So, if I put these deal functions in a merge sort, I assume that every group has one person at least who has done this. Which of these would result in a stable sorting algorithm? Which of these is a stable? Which wouldn't change the order of elements? another talk with your friends and vote kind of question. Oh, it's easier to think which of these obviously messes up the ordering or messes up the stability. To experiment a little bit. So mostly B and C got votes. Well, B and C actually are the same algorithm, and they are, you know, completely equivalent in their functioning. And now I'm hoping that I haven't made any mistakes with these. So where's the ball? Someone has the ball. Yeah. Do you have comments? So I think we have to make an experiment with this. I think you agree. So let's have a and let's hope that this doesn't take enormously long time. Have deal A. And let's take the deal of B because it's function should function completely equivalently.
Correct A1.
Yeah, I should correct, and I should actually manage to, you know, copy paste the things correctly, which is surprisingly difficult actually. Yeah, now I have deal B. So to test better, I get a proper merge sort. I need obviously a merge function. And yeah, this merge function that merges two sorted lists, pretty much everyone who did this exercise did it exactly in this way. So I think we can all agree that this is the right way to do it. And yeah, merge, and then we need a merge sort. And let's take, suppose we have this one. So let's see, we have a merge sort, we fix this to use the merge there and deal B. And do we have a compilable code? Yeah, fastest code ever. So we have to actually change the code a bit, since now this is comparing stuff by their, you know, real ordering. So let's make a small change here. I'll hard code the comparison by absolute values. I could pass this as a parameter for the function and so on to make it more general, but for short experiment in a class, it should be fine. And then I have to, since I take absolute values, A must be a number, and also here, since I'm sorting those, it must be a number. Okay. And do I have this example? So, here's A. And you are quite correct. It doesn't make a stable sorting. It actually flips this around. Then let's take B as our... Oh, sorry. I was actually wrong. It was B. B doesn't make a stable sorting order. So we were all wrong at this point. So now we have to make this hopeful deal that actually I have A that makes a stable sorting. And yeah, neither of these do that point or make a stable algorithm. Why not? Because there's this trick that you have to get right in both of the places. So in deal A, I get the first element in the list A and the second element in list B. So I should be able to fix this by choosing, in case of equal values, the correct value to put in the list. If I have case where X and Y are equal, then I can choose which of these I put first on the list, and this would allow me to at least swap around the sorting order. So let's change it to be like this. And then I get something that at least seems to be stable. So one additional kink in my explanation. So, deal A. It seems I get a stable ordering. We can test with quick check if you are not convinced. Then deal B. We also get a stable ordering. So, basically, stability seems to be achievable by both of the measures. You have to be careful on which list you pick the stuff from. So that was a kind of a trick question. So next question. That was the stability. Why did I ask this? Because the person who returned answer like this claimed that this was the only stable one. And it, at least in my mind, is not. If I'm wrong, correct me at later point. Okay, then efficiency. So this I also benchmarked. So let's spend a little more time on this. So which is the fastest algorithm? You already know the answer because I told you this. There was one other person present who is not present. Okay, which is the fastest algorithm? We haven't talked about how to analyze this thing, so any guess would do. And we, you know, broached the topic slightly before the earliest question. So at this point, don't think too much. Just, you know, pick the one that seems intuitive to you, and we discuss a little bit. I choose the wrong kind of a question format. Anyways, someone suggested A. Two bunches of people suggested that the fastest is A. Everyone agree? Yeah, why? Well, obviously it seems that since this function traverses the list only once, and even then it takes number of recursive steps proportional to half of the list. So it's, you know, if the list contains 50 elements, this will take 25 steps and it's done. Then if you contrast it to deal C, well, this has to take at least, you know, 50 steps to calculate the length. And then it needs 25 steps to, you know, take the first part of the list and 25 steps to take the rest of the list. So if you calculate purely by asymptotics, then DLC should be slower than DLA. And of course, DLB, it's the same as DLC, but in this case, it might be that the compiler doesn't notice that it's calculating the length twice. So it cannot be at least faster than the DLC. But the correct answer is that DLC is actually massively faster than DLA. And this is because of the internals of the Haskell compiler. Need to draw a bit, or actually I can type a bit so some people can read it. Because DLA, it has to allocate two new lists. It has to allocate each element in both of the lists. And it turns out that allocating memory or building new elements, new lists, is rather expensive. So how many these cons operators or add element in the front of the list happen is the critical factor in this code. So in this case, there is one add element in front of the list operation for every element of the original list. So if I had 50 elements, I have to do this 50 times. And each time I do it, it requires a little bit of memory allocation and things like this. These are, of course, extremely fast in Haskell because you do a lot of that. Then, in the DLC, if you contrast this kind of a recursion to length doesn't have to allocate anything. It just goes over the list, and just counts the element. So it's kind of fast thing. It needs to do one sum per element, then find the next element, and so on. So summing is enormously much faster than constructing a new list. Then there is this interesting part. Take function. You have programmed the take function, and you know that it's doing exactly the same thing as DLA is doing for the first list. So take the first element of the list, put it in the front, take the second element, put it into as a next element, so on. So DLC, it's going to allocate, let's say we have 50 element list, it's going to allocate 25 elements to make this first list. But for the second list, drop, you remember how drop works. You start from the end of the list, just forget elements one by one until you have forgotten enough elements and just return the rest. So what actually happens is if I have a list, so let's represent the list by this chain of arrows. The dots are some elements, and these arrows represent the constructors or these dot operators. So take will do it like this. It will copy this element, it will copy this element, it will copy this element, and so on, and link them. So this is expensive. But drop instead, it checks that, have I dropped enough elements? Haven't dropped enough elements? Have I dropped enough elements? No. Have I dropped enough? No. Have I dropped enough? Yes. And then makes a new list by reusing the tail part. So this is already allocated in the memory of the computer, so it doesn't have to allocate it again. It can just reuse the existing part of the list. So DLB is faster because it's allocating half as much as DLA. Clear. This was a rather technical explanation. Runs totally counterintuitively, at least in my mind. So if you want fast code, you might want to consider reusing parts of your data structures. And as a summary, you know, linked lists are not the most efficient data structure. They are very convenient, but if you want high performance code or you are making actual merge sort algorithm and you are not in a, you know, introductory course, then use some other data structure. You know, pure array would be much better to solve things. So basically, avoid allocating memory and use structures that are, you know, look a bit like structures in Java or C. Use arrays. Arrays are rather fast if you need performance. If you need something that is understandable, use lists. So are you still interested in evaluating the actual merge sort algorithms? We made a rather long detour about this, so I don't think this actually gives any more benefit. skip this unless someone protests. So then the N queens problem. Hands up if you did this already or tried. Yeah, great. Keep your hands up if it was difficult. Yeah, kind of difficult. So one more hands up thing. Would it be difficult if you had to do it again without looking at the original code? Okay, so I'm having a rather futile lecture because one person thinks that it might be. But then again, I have this designer recipe that I stole from, you know, one university in the United States. And it's actually a nice recipe. It helps me to work more efficiently or get started more easily. So what was the idea? The idea was that we want to place N chess queens on a chessboard. Raise your hand if you don't know what a chessboard is or how queens work in chess. You know. Yeah, so this is something that we should probably draw around. A chessboard looks a bit like this. It's a grid, a two-dimensional grid. Then there are queens, which I represent as a round ball. And usually there's only two queens in chess, but this is a bit more difficult problem. And one piece is said that it's threatening the other piece if it can move to the same square as the other piece is in. And queens move either in rows, columns, or diagonals. So the question actually asks, if you have a chessboard of a given size, can you place, or in how many different ways you can place n amount of these queens, let's say 8 queens on the board, so that none of the queens share a row or column or a diagonal. For example, these two queens don't threaten each other, and these two actually do threaten each other. So, clear? Yeah, okay. And the idea is that this is actually a hard problem. If I ask you how many possible ways are there to place this amount of queens in this kind of a board, it's almost impossible to answer without somehow splitting the problem apart. The lecture notes had one idea of how this could be split apart. Basically, just, you know, take each and every row as a separate board and so on. But to demonstrate how recursion works, we can do it like this. We divide our problem into two subproblems. Instead of asking ourselves how many different ways there are to place the queens or how many different configurations there are for the whole board, we split the board in part. Ask how many different ways are there to fit queens in this smaller board and how many different ways are there to fit it into this smaller board. So then I get the answers. The answers appear magically because of recursion. The problem, we can, at this point when we are thinking about recursive functions, we can think that the problem is already solved. So I can assume that I have proper configurations of queens in both of these halves, so that in each of these halves, no queen threatens another. And then I just need to make one whole solution about this. If I have some configurations for this board and some configurations for this board, I can then join the boards and throw out all the configurations where the queens threaten each other. And that gives me the whole solution. So the point about this design recipe is that there's two important parts. One is actually, how do I split the problem apart in a logical sense? What is my strategy? And that was, you know, splitting a board in half through the middle. Then another question that is critical is the type. So what is the type that I'm actually having? How do I model each of these sets of possible configurations in this half board? And this is the critical part. If I have split the board, I have said that I have a solution for both of these smaller boards. What does this solution look like? And if you can answer this question, then you have completed something like 80% of this entire exercise. It's that easy. But you have to first ask yourself, what do I get as a result if I solve this smaller subproblem? So, is the ball alive somewhere? Any questions? Or you can throw the ball around. Any questions? What is the, if I solved this subproblem, what do I have? What is the data type? List of queens. What is a queen? Couple of numbers. Great. That is one way to do it. Any other ideas? Throw the ball at anyone who is looking like he has an idea or she has an idea. No one has any ideas. No more ideas. Okay. Your idea about representing the configurations by coordinates is a great idea. But it has a small difficulty in this. Consider that I have coordinates for this part of the board and this part of the board. And I place a queen here. What are the coordinates for queen in this square? I mean, I could say that the coordinates are 1, 1, since this is the first row and first column of this board. Or I could say that it's actually 4, 1, because 1, 2, 3, 4, and the first column of this board. First row of this board. So these are not independent solutions. So if I have all the solutions or all possible configurations for this board, they are inherently different for the configurations for this side of the board. The algorithm needs to know which side of the board it is solving at which case. And this makes it less composable. If I wouldn't have this property, if I could represent it, the queens without taking into account whether it's on the left side or the right side of the board, I could have a more general code. And I would not need to track so many numbers. So any way to do this? Instead of storing a coordinate pair, what do I store for each queen? I can tell you the answer. It's probably too stressful if I keep asking you questions all the time and throwing balls at you. So how about just a list of x coordinates of the queens? Because it's obvious from this diagram that I drew there. Well, actually, if I look at the diagram, nothing is obvious from that. But we can't have two queens in the same row ever, in the same column. So if there's two queens in the same column, it's automatically wrong. It is not a valid configuration because the queens threaten each other. So I can represent the whole setup of queens by just numbers. So let's take the board from here. In which row is the queen? Is it on the first row, second, third, and fourth? Second queen. Which row is the queen placed? So I can have just a list of row numbers. And then this makes it easy for me. Because if I have just a list of row numbers, say 1, 3, 8, it doesn't matter which side of the board I'm solving. So I could, if I make a really strange shaped chessboard, I can even flip around the sides and I still get the valid solution. So at this point, we have decided that our queen is represented by an int relative to the beginning of the subboard. Then we have the solution that we are looking for. I gave it a new type. And the solution is list of all setups that I can make. At this point, it's tempting to actually start writing this nQueens function and try to make the recursion. But at this point, you actually should stop for a while. And then look, are there any functions that I can write that do something with my solution? I mean, if I have just a plain type, can I endow this type with some useful operations that make it behave nicely? So, for example, this is probably something that I need. I have a setup of queens. I definitely need to know if it's a valid setup of queens. And in the lecture notes, I have this nice threaten function, which allows me to, you know, check if two queens are threatening each other. And then I just make all the pairs of queens, the threatens need a coordinate pair. So I take the queens that I have in my list of queens and add a column number for each queen. So I fill in the missing coordinate pair here. Then take all combinations of queens, check that they do not threaten each other. And then I have this nice function called AND, which is rather funnily named. And it basically checks that all elements of this list are true. So is it true for all combinations of A's and B's that if I assign A from list of queens, fill in the coordinate number, do the same for B, that A doesn't threaten a B? Now, more I explain this, more difficult it gets. So I guess you understand it already. So I can check if a configuration is a valid configuration. Then one additional operator I always have when I have types, almost always, I have a way of, you know, merging things together. If I'm dealing with numbers, I have plus. If I have list, I have concatenation. And if I have queens, I have this concatenation that results in a valid board. So if I have two solutions, then I can combine this into a bigger solution. And how do I do this? Basically, I do it like this. I take all setups from list of setups here. So this is A is now a full setup of queens. It has some number of queens placed on the board. I draw another setup from list of B's. So there's another setting of the queens. Since I have this idea that the first argument is the left side of the board and the second argument is the right side of the board, I can combine these into single solution by just summing the numbers. This is probably the only confusing part of the code. So you see why this would result in a new configuration of queens. Yes, no. All confused stairs. So basically, let's draw a bit. And I can't overemphasize the meaning of pen and paper when programming. So let's have two chessboards. Let's make them into a rather small chessboard. So, yeah, two boards. I have one queen here and another queen here. Another board has a queen here and let's say queen here. Now, what is the encoding of this configuration? Well, each configuration was represented by a list of numbers. So what kind of a list of numbers do I have here? Oh no, the person with the soft ball is responsible for getting the answer out of the class. So either answer it by yourself or throw at someone who can answer. And we play ball until we get the answer. And at this point, it's advisable to look behind you if the ball is behind you, because otherwise it might be rather nasty. So, okay, I have this kind of configuration. If I represent it by list of numbers, how do I represent it? What kind of a list of numbers represents this half of the chessboard where the queens are like this? The coding was that you encode for each queen in which row it is placed on. So this is placed on the... Yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah. Yeah, of course. You were correct for the first time. I just, you know, was nasty for you, at you. Okay, the second one then. Two and four, yeah. Okay, then again, if I want the configuration for the whole board, meaning that I erase this divide here, the first queen is in the first row, second is in the fifth, third is in the second, and the fourth is in the fourth row. So basically, I can do this by simply concatenating these lists together. Right. Okay, I should avoid using Blackboard because it's terribly confusing for everyone. But now we all know how this works. Hands up if you don't know how this works. This is the certain way of making people put their hands down. So, basically this allows me to get a new solution out of two existing solutions. But in case that these solutions are not compatible, both have the queen in the first row, that is not a valid n-queen solution. So I have to add a condition. In list comprehensions, you have these generators, draw A from A's, you have let statements, let variable sol be equal to this expression, and then we have also these predicates. The predicate means that, you know, check that solution is valid. If it's not valid, then skip this element. So this is a way for me to merge two n-queen solutions. You know, pretty simple actually. Take all the combinations, throw away those combinations that don't work, and just concatenate the rest together. So if you would have this, then how would you actually implement this? Because at this point we have, everything is done already. We can generate a set of solutions for one column boards. That's easy. We can check if the solutions are valid. And we can merge two solutions. So there's actually plenty of ways to make this happen. Just give me one way. You can either use this pattern or some other pattern. So I'm pretty sure that this will be a horrible place to be as a student, since I'm going to make you write code of a very hard exercise, and I'm going to give you exactly 7.5 minutes of time to do it. But you know, I think if you got what I was talking about, this shouldn't be at all difficult. So don't mind about the syntax or getting everything correctly. Just figure out how to do this. What goes in the place of undefined? So let's divide the problem into two. If I'm solving a list of or board that is, you know, just one column wide, how do I get the solution by using operators here? And it actually helps you if you have a laptop and you can look at both of the slides at the same time. So, first undefined. Write me a function that will solve one column n-queen problems. Function to solve one column n-queen problems. Do this in groups. Please discuss. And basically, you know, just look at the types. I mean, consider that the types are opaque, so you can't go inside types and write something. These are the operators that you can use, and that's all. And also this is a trick question, like all my questions unfortunately are. This is probably a better view of the code, since you can see all of the code. then start waving at me when you are, you know, happy with the first undefined. Yeah, one. Another waving test if you don't wave. Probably select a better protocol for indicating that you are done. So instead of waving at me, start yawning. That is much more indicative. Yeah, I think, you know, at least I see that most of you have stopped discussing this. And five answers. Yeah, it's a row height. This is a trick question because I already have written the code for this. This makes a solution for single column board. So, yeah, I can just use that. Yeah, simple. So, a row height. Now I can solve all problems with just single strips of the board. Okay. Cool. This is simple. The base case is usually very simple. So next undefined. So at this point I really like one feature of the new Haskell compiler, which is that I can write an underscore in the code and it will then hint me what I should write on the place. And every time I try to use this in the lecture videos, it fails and it always fails. But at this point, I think it might be interesting to try again. Yeah. So, if I put a underscore there, it's failing to actually tell me anything usable. So, yeah. Like I said, always fails during lectures. So, what do I put here? What's here? So, yeah, I can think we can continue with, no, we can't continue with that. Yeah, so, second, what do I write here? Now, you have the base case. So you know that you have to use recursion. I mean, you absolutely have to use recursion to solve this, because otherwise it's not going to work at all. So what you need to do is somehow divide this into subproblems. I told you how to divide this into subproblems. And then you have to make me somehow solve these subproblems and combine them. And let's see if we can do this. And again, if you spend time modeling the types that you are using in your code well, this solution will basically write itself. want the actual code, you can go to this course web page / downloads, and you find all the code examples there, badly named. This one is NQ lecture, so you can pick it up from here if you want to actually try. Not necessary, however, and don't have to make a syntactically correct solution. Hint, split the problem apart. Assume that the recursion magically solves the parts, combine the parts. That's all you need to do. That's all you ever need to do with the recursive problems. Okay, are we getting more than 3 answers? And of course, if you are only having a cell phone, this might be a horrible exercise to do. So, 4 answers, great. One more and we have 5. If you actually wrote something really funny there and just laughing because I didn't, you know, check what the answer was, then yeah, you won. I guess since that side of the classroom is getting restless, we can look at the answers. So basically, 4 answers. Yeah. Okay, and all answers have the exactly same pattern. Except this one. So what happens if I I guess I can make automatically these multiple choice questions. Now that you've seen the answers, choose the one you like. So I don't have to give lecture at all. I can just throw questions at you and, make them self-replicate. So, choose the one you like. I guess we are somewhat settled on this. Yeah, C is leading. Great. So basically, D in this set of answers. What's wrong with D? Quickly, you have the ball. What is wrong with D? Yeah, merge is given one argument only, and I have a guess. I'm almost certain that this is because someone pressed enter prematurely on their keyboard. Okay. A, well, A is a bit self-explanatory. It kind of works, but only if the width is, you know, even. So if I say, for example, have a board of size 5 that I'm calculating, then I take 5, divided by 2, round down, I have number 2. If I solve a board of width 2 and another board of width 2, I get board of width 4, which is actually not really solving solution for the board of size 5. And B, so if I have board of width 8, then does this work? Any comments on this? So if I board that is 8 squares wide, then this will be 4 squares, and this will be 5 squares, and then if I compare, join answers for the 4 square chessboard and the 5 square chessboard, I actually get a 9 square chessboard. So, no? Is it? So, well, this is easy to test, actually, since I have the code on the screen, so... Yeah, that teaches me not to paste into Vim without insert mode. Yeah, let's see. N queens of 4 times 4 board. Yeah, and it gives 4 numbers. Yeah, and let's check. 1, 2, 3. Oh, yeah, I was wrong. Thank you for correcting me. Can you explain why? Why I was wrong? Yeah, this is, points for you for seeing that so fast, because that's, at least for me, it's totally not obvious on the first glance. The next recursive step will eat the, you know, additional one square away, and everything works perfectly. So, yeah. And, you know, basically, I would still, you know, say that you could write this in a rather nicer way, because this is, that's clever, that's very clever. But if the guy who is actually maintaining your code, is he clever enough? That's a big question. So I can do it like this. Easiest way, every time I have a complex expression, I can just use a local binding, give a nicer name to things. L is not a nice name, but we are writing code live, so let's go with that. So first calculate what is the width divided by 2, then take the first part, and then take the second part, which is, you know, basically what is left from the first, after the first part is taken away. And like you said, we don't have to do this, but, you know, at this point, I'm so, I'm not enough smart. From this, I can deduce what's going to happen. And you, you know, observed that, you know, in the case of B, I just could not. So basically, one lesson, write code that other people understand. Or if you want to be clever, please be clever and just, you know, write a comment that explains what is happening, like, if something like this appears there, then it's all okay. And this is, you know, one thing that you can really use to kill the teaching assistant performance. Submit all exercises in having this kind of trick there, and they have to spend 1.5 hours instead of 1 minute to grade your exercises. So, yeah, but where were we? So we actually managed to solve this problem in, you know, 15 minutes, pretty much all groups who had a laptop. So what was the point? The point was this. Before doing the recursion, think about the types. Make proper types to represent your problem. Make operations for those types. See how they combine, how they are split apart, how they can be summed or subtracted from each other. And then start the recursive function. Because at that point, it's going to be easier. If you don't do any of these, then you have to inline the merge into this, you know, you are writing code, and instead of saying merge here, you are going to write 3 lines of code in this exact place. And then you get a huge mess, which is quite hard to read. But if you have these logical operators, there's a solution here, there's a solution here, and here is a function for, you know, merging the solutions, everything is going to be nice. Also, what is interesting about this solution here is that if we have these types, this is only one way of generating the boards. Because the merge actually works for, you know, any sizes of boards. So you could do the exact solution that is presented in the lecture notes. You could just, you know, generate 8 slices of the board and then recursively merge these slices. And that would also work, I think. Haven't actually tried. But yeah, onwards. I still have almost 10 minutes, and I can quickly demonstrate what we are going to be doing for the next week, or most of you are probably going to be doing for the next week. So, after 6 weeks of Haskell, we finally find out how to make input and output. And 6 weeks is actually a fast time, because Haskell was invented in something like, you know, 80 or so, and it took something like 6 years to figure out how to do input and output properly in a pure functional language. And to me, the solution for how to do input and output without doing any side effects, it's kind of a, you know, cheat, but it's a nice cheat and a useful one, so we'll discuss a little bit about it. And you can make real Haskell programs. So the whole thing is based on this useful lie. This is not how the compiler does it, but this is equivalent to how the compiler does it. So there are values that have type IOX, where X is some type, so IO int or IO string. And the values of type IO, whatever, represent input-output actions. So if I have IO string, it's probably an input action that is somehow pulling a string either from the keyboard or from internet or somehow reaching outside of the computer and getting some input back as a string. The idea is that instead of allowing these inputs to happen in pure functions when we are evaluating the nice recursive functions, for example, we do it like this. The Haskell runtime expects that if you compile a program, there will be a symbol called main. And the main contains some kind of an expression that evaluates to IO parentheses. Do you know what the parentheses are? So first difficulty. I never remember to explain this symbol for anyone. So that's a value. Value of parentheses, parentheses. Type of parentheses, parentheses. So this is a silly type. So how would I write this? Yeah, throw that away for a while. So this is equivalent of writing a type definition like this. You know, in most cases we have something like colors, red, green, blue, and so on. So we can do enumerations like this. Then if I do something like this, I have one element enumeration. So type unit has one value called unit. And that's how the parentheses are defined. Yeah, I have value called unit which has the type unit. So basically what's this? This is the most stupid type ever. It has only one value, it can never be anything else. And we use this value in all places where we have to write a type, but we actually don't have anything reasonable to put in. So suppose that we wouldn't have this nice maybe type. Then we would be forced, instead of having a here are a list of maybe types. You know, these are probably results of some computation. First computation failed to produce anything, second computation produced the value 56. Now suppose that we didn't have the maybe type in the language. We could use the either type. So that list, let's not kill it. That is of type maybe int. Now suppose that we don't have maybes. We could, of course, make it like this. It's either an int or it's something else. And what the something else is, since if you are modeling the exact thing, if it's not an int, there's nothing reasonable to put into place. So we can use this unit type to fill in all the places where we need types but don't have any sensible choice. So something like this. Okay, so the brackets, they are just a silly type that has no values whatsoever. So the useful life. When the Haskell program is compiled, the main expression is evaluated. It results in a value of type IO, brackets. It's an IO action that just does something, doesn't return anything. Then after our program is completed, we have the IO action. Then the runtime is going to execute that IO action. So if we say main equals print hello world, then the program is going to evaluate the result of a main. It's an IO action. Then the program terminates and the IO action is run. So all IO actions actually happen after the program has kind of terminated. So all functions appear because there are no IO actions. You know, this is a kind of a lie. You can think of it as, you know, the main is a thing that returns another program that does all these imperative things and is then executed. So that's kind of one way of knowing how you can do IO. So next question is probably then, where do I get these values of IO whatever? Where do I get the values of IO string, for example? And the answer is that they are almost all predefined. So I have, for example, this function return, allows me to make an IO action of any type I like. I can say return unit, and I get an IO action that does absolutely nothing and returns the unit value. I could say return 13, and I would get an IO action that does no side effects, no input output, just produces the value 13. Then I have these other predefined things like getLine. It's an IO action that produces a string. When it's executed, it somehow reads the keyboard and gives back a string. Then there are IO actions that I can make by calling some predefined functions. For example, function put string on a line. I'm not pronouncing the acronym there. This is a function, ordinary, completely bog standard Haskell function. Takes a string as an input and returns an IO action. When this IO action is executed, after our program has terminated, it will print out the string used to construct the IO action. So pretty strange, right? And if these are the only ways of, you know, defining IO actions, all Haskell programs would be very, you know, silly. I could either do nothing, read input, or print a string. So not very useful programs can be made like this. There are, of course, plenty more of these actions, but these suffice for explaining how things work. Besides of having these predefined values of IO something, we have ways for combining the IO values. And this deviates from the lecture notes quite heavily. I have two operators. these are just plus and minus in the same category. They should fit in the same category in your mind. This first one is kind of a plus operation. It takes two I/O actions. For example, print hello, print world. And if I join them together with this operator, I get an I/O action that does both of the side effects. So, for example, if I have an A, yeah, let's do. So this, if I have this I/O action, it prints me a hello. If I use this operator, I can put two I/O actions back to back. So one thing here is, again, reading Haskell expressions. So you have to know where the brackets go. So the first argument of this thing is the first print, and the second argument is the second print. The type of the whole thing, it's I/O brackets. So basically, takes two actions, I/O, whatever, and produces one action that does the side effects contained in both of the actions, and it returns the value returned by the second I/O action. So I could, you know, do something like this. This is an I/O action, prints hello, then does absolutely nothing, and it returns me 42. Gives me an I/O action, which is some kind of a number. Okay, that's easy. That's very easy. Everyone will, you know, understand this in 5 minutes. Then comes the difficult part. There is another way of combining the functions. This is almost the same as the previous one, except that the first one gets two I/O actions and it just sums them together. The second one is not as lucky. It gets one I/O action, then it gets a function that will return another I/O action. So what it does, it takes the first argument, executes the I/O action, it produces a value, let's say 42. Then it takes this function. Notice that the function takes as an input an A, which is the same thing that is returned or, you know, acquired by the first I/O action. So first I/O action is executed, the runtime now has an A. Then the runtime sees that, yeah, here is a function taking an A, I can feed it an A, I get an IOB, an I/O action out of that. So it evaluates the function, gets another I/O action, and then evaluates the I/O action it just got. So this allows me to mix in logic in the proceedings. And I'm not going to make this question since I have exactly 2 minutes of time and no 6 slides. So basically, how does this work? I get something like, well, get line. That is the simplest I/O action of any sort. It's I/O string. Then I can make some kind of function of type string to I/O string, for example. It takes a plain string, and then I have to make an, now let's make a now simpler I/O action. I/O that's not returning anything. Takes a string, must return an I/O brackets. Well, print is very nice way of returning I/O brackets. So I have function. I have get line. I have a func. Then I have this operator, so I can take getLine. It's a nice function, produces I/O value. I combine this I/O value with this function. The compiler will, or the runtime will execute this action, feed that value returned by that action into this function, which returns another I/O action which the runtime will execute. So that is an I/O action of type brackets, and works like this. So, nothing to it. So, basically, you can do a pretty complex logic with this. I mean, I can obviously somehow modify the string before calling this print function, which gets me a different kind of an I/O action. I can make if statements and so on, whatever I like. So this is the way. Every step in the program is actually a new function. So when you are making Haskell programs that do I/O, you divide the program in steps. First you do something, then you make a function which consumes the something and produces the next step. Then you make a function that consumes what the second step made and produces the third step. And then you use these arrowhead operators, or binds as they are called, to combine all of your functions into one bigger I/O action. And I'm not going to write the game since I spent 1 minute too much. I might, hands up if you want a screencast where I do this. I can record it and, I can make this. So the lecture is continued online. And we'll get back to that next week. So have a fun weekend, and if you want, one administrative thing I just recalled. The Friday sessions are below the minimum number of people. So I can't make supervised sessions with less than 7 people. And last time there were 4 people. So this week, unless I see in Korppi that you have checked that there's at least 7 people coming to that session, I have to cancel it. So if you want the Friday sessions to continue, please click your name there. Otherwise, have a nice weekend.